Okay, we're going to go ahead and start dishing with, not with Dolores.
Dolores is not here.
Dolores is not here tonight.
Well, I'm leaving.
Okay. Totally your choice. So, Dolores is sick tonight, so we want to be sure we pray for her. I don't know what plague, what form of the plague she has. She's coughing. Coughing up a lung, according to Steve Rader. So tonight we have with us Tom Ehlers, Fire Chief of Galena Park. It's so very exciting for him, I know. It is. It's a great thing. And he's going to talk to us about all kinds of really great things. I think y'all all know him, but I'm going to go ahead and pass it off to him.
Good? All right. Yeah. No, it's good. So, like JT said, I'm the Fire Chief of Galena Park. I've been the Fire Chief of Galena Park.
And our safety guru.
Yeah, safety guru. I've been the Fire Chief in Galena Park for a little over 100 days now. So, I have a degree in architecture from Virginia Tech. Before becoming a firefighter 10 years ago, I had a whole other career in architecture and construction. Steve Rader's trying to figure out the volume on the TV here. I started out as a volunteer firefighter in Northwest Fire Department, which is up in Northwest Harris County, and then became a paid firefighter, and then I went and got my paramedic. I worked in Galveston for Galveston EMS for about 2.5 years. Then I ended up in Galena Park, and I was a firefighter in Galena Park for about 2.5 years before I took a promotion to fire marshal. And then I was a fire marshal for all of 9 days, and I got promoted to fire chief. So not how I thought they were going to work out. I figured I could have a nice 10 years worth in the fire marshal's office, and I had all of 9 days. So. What I want to talk to you guys about, obviously, like, I could talk about all kinds of, I could talk for hours on like, this and that and just everything, but a big thing right now in the fire world is fire safety. So there was a little bit of a drop-off in civilian deaths and things, and now they're going back up again. So there's a couple of different reasons for that. It used to be in the 70s and 80s, everybody smoked cigarettes, and kids had matches and, you know, played with lighters and all those sorts of things. The good news is that people aren't smoking anymore. So those sorts of deaths and things are starting to go down. People still die in fires, unfortunately, from smoking in bed. If we have any smokers in here, please don't smoke in bed. It's not a good idea. You fall asleep, you burn yourself up. So the great thing, though, is people don't have matches and lighters and things laying around anymore, so our children aren't being exposed to that. I mean, when I was a kid, it was very easy to get matches and lighters and all that and play with fire. Nowadays, it's a little bit harder. Plus, they're distracted with cell phones. Can you?
Perfect.
Yeah, it's, hopefully I remember what room this is in. So this is, can you pause it for 1 second? So this is a side-by-side comparison of simulated room furnishings. The typical furnishings that you would find at, like, your grandmother's house, or, you know, you would have been able to purchase from a store in the 70s and the 80s, possibly early 90s. There's been a change in how furniture is made, and it's all, unfortunately, is now made of plastic. So,
what?
Yes. So basically, your furniture that you have in your house is formed cans of gasoline, basically. And this video is going to show you the difference between the two rooms, and it's pretty scary, actually. So go ahead and play it, Steve. I'll let it.
Am I going to have to buy all new furniture?
Well, I don't know. Your wife's not here, so maybe you won't.
Well, yeah.
And there's no volume with this. I wish there was volume with it so you could actually hear what the fire sounds like, because it's very disturbing. But so two firemen have gone into identically sized rooms. This is the legacy room, so this is your older type of furniture. So it'd be made out of wool, silks, cottons, those sorts of things. The modern room is going to be made out of all our wonderful plastics, rayon, polyurethane, all these other wonderful things that make our world better. So what they did was they took a candlestick, they lit the candlestick, and they set it on the couch. So you can see the little flame here. That's the candle wax that's burning. Okay. Unfortunately, whoever set this room up, they put a flower pot right here, so you can't see, but you're going to see it in just a second.
The time is from when they lit the candle?
Mm-hmm. When they place the candle on the couch. You can already start to see some of the smoke. I don't know if you can see it all the way in the back.
Oh, yeah, I can see it.
Now you see the flame?
Mm-hmm. Burning hotter.
That's just burning all those poisons out into the atmosphere.
Yes. So this fire is still roughly about the same size. What's mostly burning here is the wax from the candle. This is clearly involves the plastics in the couch. So the smoke is already banked down. You can see the smoke already coming over the wall, the top.
I knew that was the reason why I like antique furniture.
Do you have a favorite flammable material?
So at work, I sit on about 500 million gallons of gasoline in all the tank farms that are in the city and around the city. So I'd probably pick gasoline. So as you can see, I mean, it's been exponential growth. This is still a pretty relatively small fire. You could easily put this out with a glass of water. This you're not going to put out. So this is going to run until the room completely flashes over. So what happens is, when this room flashes over, the temperature in that room is 1,200 degrees Fahrenheit. So you're not going to survive.
If you have a home-grade fire extinguisher, I guess I should have asked, at what point did we reach the level where it would have been effective and now it's no longer?
Probably about a minute ago. At 2 minutes, you probably might have had a chance to put that out, but probably not. So this room is almost completely flashed. You can see the fire and the smoke, and everything is on fire now. You see the other couches, they're igniting.
So explain that, it's just not getting the curtains.
Flashing over thing, you have a specific temperature point for that. Is that like a technical thing that happens with fire?
Yeah, so you reach a certain temperature in the room, and everything auto-ignites. So a piece of wood, for example, if you put a section of 2x4 in your oven and you turned on your oven to about 450 degrees, eventually the wood would heat up, it would catch fire. So wood will start to burn at 450 degrees. So this room is flashed. Nothing in there is going to survive. So total flashover is 3 minutes 40 seconds. This room you can still put out. If you had your fire extinguisher, you could extinguish that room. So it's going to speed up here in a second, and it'll show you how much time you have to flash over in this room. So now they've speeded it up.
So I thought modern furnishings were supposed to have like flame retardant chemicals and the stuffing that California required, and now California doesn't like them because it causes cancer.
So now we're at 25 minutes in this room.
You don't want flame retardants in your
air. Now you're at 29 minutes in this room.
Nathan, this is probably too late for
your fire extinguisher. Yeah, this would be too late for your fire extinguisher. So that's the end of the video. So everything is made out of plastics, which, you know, it obviously comes from petroleum. But what happens when you heat these things up is they break down into other chemicals. So, like, for example, we just had a fire at one of the Shell refineries, and they manufacture lubricants. and the lubricant was heated to about 650 degrees. Well, once it hit about 500 degrees, the chemical splits. And one of the chemicals, the flash point, is roughly 490 degrees Fahrenheit, which is pretty good for an oil. The problem was is the other temperature for the other one was about 40 degrees Fahrenheit, which is basically gasoline. And as soon as it came out, it was exposed to the atmosphere, it ignited. It's a similar concept. I mean, these are all made of plastics, and yes, some of them are coated with flame retardants and things. There's different rules for commercial buildings. Commercial buildings typically are required to have flame retardant materials in them. Residential construction, on the other hand, there aren't the rules. So you can go into the store and get anything you want from China, Vietnam, wherever, where a lot of this furniture is made, and it's all synthetic, it's all plastic. So it burns very, very quickly. And that's one of the problems we're seeing is these fires grow exponentially. So you saw in the first one, it was 1 minute, then 2 minutes, then 3 minutes, how big the fire has gotten. And so the amount of time you have to get out of your house is a lot shorter. So I'm not saying run out and go buy all new furniture, but just be aware of what you're putting in your house. Antique furniture is great. You know, solid oak, you know, solid pine, whatever, you know, wools, silks. Yeah, they're beautiful, they're expensive, those sorts of things, but they don't burn as fast. So there is a safety component to it to kind of pay attention to. You want to do the next one, Steve?
So where do you buy your furniture from?
Unfortunately,
cleaning your gutters is not only a dirty, time-consuming task, it's dangerous too.
So it's dangerous.
So stay off the ladder and protect your home with Leaf.
We're here at the Delaware County Emergency Services Training Center in Pennsylvania, where we're repurposing one of our test fixtures to do a demonstration for Fire Prevention Week on the importance of closing your door. This year's theme, Close Before You Doze, will let us highlight the importance of putting that important barrier between you and the potential fire before you go to sleep at night. We're going to have an experiment where we're going to light the fire in the living room, cutting off your main source of egress. We're going to see how long it takes those smoke alarms to go off to give you that early warning, and look at what important role that the closed door plays in providing you time to be woken, understand what's happening around you, decide whether or not you can get out safely or not, and ultimately, if you can't, the important protection that it provides you to buy you time so the fire department can come to rescue you. In this three-bedroom house, what's important to us is how long the occupants would have to survive. In order to determine that, we've got temperature measurements at every foot in every room in the house. We've got oxygen, carbon monoxide, and carbon dioxide measurements in the bedrooms as well as the hallway to understand what the potential occupants would be exposed to, along with our regular measurements of pressure, video, thermal imaging throughout the house so we can quantify the fire behavior.
So this is basically the modern furniture in this house. So the fire, again, is going to happen very, very quickly. And if I have one piece of advice, if you're going to listen to anything that I say tonight, absolutely close your door when you go to bed at night. Okay, and you'll see why here in a minute. So good.
Start the fire by lighting a sofa with a candle in the living room. That fire is going to begin to spread across the sofa, filling the house with smoke and heat. That smoke is going to begin to bank down. What we're looking at is the obvious difference in conditions between the open bedroom and the closed bedrooms and what that means for occupant survival time. We're going to allow that fire to progress, and we're going to be watching the front windows to the living room. The question to us is going to be, are those front living room windows going to fail or not? That fire is going to become ventilation limited. The windows are going to go out. We're going to have fire out of the front of the house, and we're going to continue to look at how that deteriorates conditions inside the house. Once we have that fire out the windows and things are not survivable in the open bedroom, we're going to have our suppression crew go ahead and move in for the fire out. Thank you.
that was before when you opened the bedroom door. This is after. Can you pause it for a second?
So the peak temperature 4 feet off the floor, so about this high, is 500 degrees Fahrenheit. What do you think is going to happen if you stand up? Or even if you sit up in bed, what's going to happen? You're going to completely cook your lungs. That's it. It's game over. Not to mention you are completely in this just noxic, this just noxious, toxic soup of smoke. Phosgene gas, hydrogen sulfide, carbon monoxide, just a lot of really, really bad things that unfortunately they're going to kill you. 600 parts per million of carbon monoxide at 4 feet off the floor. You're probably not going to wake up. The carbon monoxide is going to overtake you way before you even have a chance to realize what's going on. The bad thing about carbon monoxide is it makes you sleepy, it makes you groggy, it disorients you. I've made plenty of house fires where people are coming stumbling out the door and you're asking them, is anybody in the house? And they're like, in the house? What do you mean there's a house? And they turn around and they're like, well, that's my house. It's because they get carbon monoxide poisoning. They don't know what's going on. So it's very, very dangerous. So they're going to switch over to the room with the door closed. Go ahead and pause it, Steve. So what do you notice? That this room's a lot cleaner, right? What's the temperature 4 feet off the floor? 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Okay. The carbon monoxide, though, is 600 parts per million. You can survive. You can survive in there on that. It's not going to be comfortable for you, and you probably are going to have to go to the hospital, and there's going to be, you know, you're going to get monitored and some other things. It's going to be problematic. But if you're in this room, when the fire department gets there, we can get you out that window, and, you know, we can provide you with medical care. It's survivable. That is very, very, very much survivable. So one of the techniques is firefighters that we get trained on. It's called ventilate enter search, VES. So one of the things we do, like you saw the fire blowing out the front door and out the front window. We know where the fire is at that point. And we can tell by looking at your house more than likely where the bedrooms are. So we train on literally breaking this window, getting in that window, immediately closing the door if it's not closed, and searching the room. If we got to this house and we got to the other room where the door was already open, you probably would have been dead. We would have found you. There wouldn't have been much we could do. This room, absolutely, we're going to save you. So it's very, 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 very important. Even with the modern construction that we have, most doors in most residences now, they're not solid doors. Back in the 50s and the 60s and 70s and even the 80s, we all had solid wood doors in our house. Now, they're all hollow core doors. Basically, it's pressed cardboard. And that's the door that they used here. And it saved this room. I can't tell you how many fires I made where the outside of the door is completely burned away and the inside is fine. And this is where we find people. So... So how many of you sleep with the door open? I know a lot of people have kids, and we do that because we have kids and we want to hear. But how many people sleep with the door open? Almost everybody, right? So there's been a huge push to get this changed, because it can actually save your life. And with all the modern furnishings and things that we have, unfortunately, I've made fires where just the television has caught on fire. Okay? How much plastic is in this TV right here? It puts off a lot of toxic smoke, toxic gases, and unfortunately, I've arrived on scene, and a lot of times these will burn out because they're hanging on the wall and there's nothing else to catch fire. But you find this big blob of plastic on the floor and the house is filled with smoke, and you go in there and the carbon monoxide levels are through the roof on our gas detectors and things like that. And the family says, well, you know, there was all this smoke we couldn't see, and all it was a TV. Just the TV caught fire. And so just little things like this that we just take for granted and we don't think about, there's not much we can do about it. What are we going to do, not have TVs in our house? But just being aware that, hey, I really do need to close my door at night just in case the TV catches fire. Because we all leave our TVs plugged in at night, right? Nobody unplugs their TV before they go to bed or anything like that. And then fortunately, they do catch on fire. Let's go with the next one, Steve. Sorry for the commercials. So this is the Christmas tree fire. So at Christmas time, how many of you guys like the natural Christmas trees? So as long as you keep the tree watered, you'll see here in a minute. Go ahead and see. So they light this tree on fire first. So now they just lit this tree on fire. So in less than 10 seconds. So water your Christmas tree. So the fire got so big it ends up spreading over to the other side that's divided by the wall. So literally this is less than a minute. So you thought your couch burned quickly. The Christmas tree is going to burn exponentially faster. So please, please, please water your Christmas tree.
In homes that are, it's not Christmas, it's not like a space heater, but just like your average, everyday home in Houston, what is your biggest source of fires? Or did you already answer this before?
No, I haven't answered it. So, the majority of fires are caused by cooking, and that's actually the next thing that we're gonna get to. So,
for his wife. Watch as he pours the flaming brandy into a hot pan.
What?
Oh.
Keep going.
What?
Very quickly, he's got a disaster on his hands. Nutley, New Jersey Fire Captain David Hamilton says you should never, ever transfer flaming alcohol from one pan to another.
You look for that. The flame is still going to want to come up. So as he's pouring, the flame is still coming out of the pan and going up, even though the liquid's pouring in.
YouTube is loaded with other frightening videos of kitchen cooking catastrophes.
Holy
Cooking with oil can lead to grease fires, which are particularly dangerous. Can you believe this sudden burst of flames is the result of water being thrown on a grease fire? We're cooking and grease catches fire like this. What do we do?
Worst thing you can do, throw water on it. Here, throw the water on it, watch what happens.
Okay. Oh my gosh.
Wait, just
still float on top of it. Sprays it everywhere. Makes a much bigger mess, much bigger fire.
So, what's the proper way of putting out a grease fire?
Easiest thing, put the lid right on top of it.
In the case of a small fire, you can also use baking soda. Oh, wow. But the safest and most effective way to put out a grease fire is with a fire extinguisher. And Captain Hamilton says, when using a fire extinguisher, the word to remember is pass.
You would pull the pin, aim at the base of the fire, squeeze, and sweep.
Whatever you do, remember, when it comes to grease fires, water is definitely not the way to go. Oh my gosh.
So, I can't tell you how many grease fires I've made.
Made?
I haven't made as a term of, you know, we end up getting called out because all houses on fire because of them. Cooking fires are a huge part of what we do. People forget that they leave stuff on the stove. You get situations like this where the cooking oil will actually auto-ignite. Oil will keep absorbing the heat from your stove until it reaches its ignition temperature. And once it ignites, it's going to burn until you put it out. The easiest way to do that is put something over top of it. Whether that's a cookie sheet or whether that's the lid to the pot, whatever, it's going to snuff out that fire. Whatever you do, don't throw water on it. When you throw the water on it, the water immediately boils, expands, and it pushes all of the oil out on everything. And a lot of times the people that do put the water on it, they're the ones that get burned. Or they end up catching their whole house on fire. People fall asleep a lot. They'll start cooking dinner. I can't tell you how many times this has happened. Where they go to sit on the couch, they put something on the stove, and they doze off. And next thing they know, their kitchen is on fire because they only meant to close their eyes for a minute, and it's an hour later, and now their kitchen's on fire. So it happens a lot. The fire extinguisher, you can get any of those fire extinguishers at Home Depot. Pull, aim, squeeze, sweep. Okay? So pull the pin, aim it at the base of the fire, squeeze the handle, and just go in a sweeping motion.
Is it easy to do?
Yeah, it's pretty easy to do. Just remember with dry chemical extinguishers, you're going to get a big cloud of dry chemical in the air. It can irritate your lungs and things, but it also is better than your house burning down too. And you can stand pretty far away. You don't have to stand as close as they stood. Most of those have a pretty good distance on them, 3 to 6 feet, depending on the brand and those sorts of things. So
generally, what's the shelf life?
So typically, those fire extinguishers, the containers, the canisters that they're in, they should be tested every 6 years, hydrostatically pressure tested. Most of the residential ones, it's not worth you taking it to the company that's going to hydrostatically test that cylinder. It's going to cost you more to test it than it is to buy a new one. So typically, replace them. I recommend replacing them every 5 years. Just go buy a new one every 5 years. They're not terribly expensive.
How much are they?
Amazon. You can pick them up for $15, $20.
What do you do with your old one if you've never used it?
You can practice with it. You can practice with it, and it is a good thing to practice with it. Go get a metal trash can and put some newspaper in it, and I'm not telling you to start a fire or anything.
This is expired.
You can practice with it.
Take the expired trash that you have.
Yes. So this next video is going to talk about the different types of smoke detectors.
We all have smoke alarms in our homes.
We go to the store, grab one off the shelf, put in a battery, and install it. But paying attention to the type you use can make a big difference in how quickly. Your family is alerted to a fire. WCCO's Jennifer Merrily put smoke alarms to the test, and what she found prompted a Minnesota fire marshal to change what he has in his own home.
Smoke alarms are by far the most effective way to get your family out safely when there's a fire. Still, statistics show one out of every four people who die in a house fire die when there's a working smoke alarm in the home.
If it starts getting smoky in here, just put this mask on.
So we went to one of the leading experts in Minnesota, Jamie Novak, to put them to the test. There are three types you can buy.
This is the ionization smoke detector. This is normally the one that most people have in their house because they're the most inexpensive. Ionization tend to detect open flaming fires faster, and photoelectric tend to detect slow smoldering fires faster.
There's also a dual sensor, which incorporates both technologies. With the help of Coon Rapids Fire Marshal Todd Williams, Novak mounted the three types to the ceiling of a Coon Rapids home. We first set a smoldering fire.
Now we'll simulate somebody falling asleep, dropping a cigarette in here.
A smoldering fire smokes for a long time before it turns to flames, if it ever does. The majority of people who die in a fire die from breathing in too much smoke, not the fire itself.
A lot of the slow smoldering fires tend to be at night when you're asleep and not going to react. The slow smoldering fire during the day isn't that big and dangerous because you should notice the smoke and have plenty of time to get out.
The dual sensor is the first to sound, 32 minutes and 40 seconds after the smoldering fire started. 10 seconds later, the photoelectric starts to glare. You can still see clearly through the room. Another 15 minutes go by, and the smoke started to irritate my lungs.
And it's starting to bother my eyes, so it's time to put the mask on.
This will help me with my breathing.
As time ticks by, the ionization smoke alarm still hasn't sounded. It becomes harder to see through the smoke. Novak eventually needs to put on a mask, and Williams decides it's time to retreat.
Definitely want to get out of this room. So if I would wake up without a smoke detector, sit up in this smoke condition, it would really be tough. Then you factor in sleeping and darkness. It would be scary at this point to get out of your house.
Nearly in evidence, the photoelectric and the combination smoke alarm sounded. The ionization smoke alarm finally went out.
But truly is surprised at the big difference between the two.
So how do the smoke alarms fare in a flaming fire? We're going to show you. This is your kitchen fire, or children playing with matches. All three types went off within 3.5 minutes of each other. What's important to note is during our test, we could still get out safely when all of the smoke alarms sounded.
Do you think if more people had photoelectric smoke detectors in their home, more lives could be saved?
I think so. I think on some of the small burning fires, that might be a big difference that make the difference between being alive or dead after a fire.
All right, you saw Todd Williams leave the room because of the smoke. After our test, he changed the smoke alarms in his home. Williams is a husband and father. He's also the fire marshal in Coon Rapids and a 26-year veteran of the fire industry. He was part of the 90% of the population who only had ionization smoke alarms in their homes. He decided to place them with the dual sensor alarms. So you're probably wondering, how do I find out what kind of smoke alarm I have? Well, you look on the back of it, and the fine print should say ionization or photoelectric. And Frank, in a store, the front of the packaging should have it clearly labeled. For example, here it has a P for photoelectric.
Yeah, hard to see on TV, but it's easy to see. This is a real eye-opener. I have to imagine there's got to be a price difference between these two, then, right?
There is. The most common kind, the ionization that most people have in their homes, is a lot cheaper. It's $5 to $10. The photoelectric is 20 and up, and the dual sensor is about 30 plus, and it could run even more if they're hardwired in your home. The one thing that we want to stress is any working smoke detector is better than nothing.
Sure. And there's a dramatic difference that you showed us.
There is a dramatic difference.
Tom, what's the best thing to do when you have a lot of fire detectors and some of them just go crazy at random times? Is it to hit them with the bat? Or
yeah.
Like when someone takes a shower and it goes off.
So if someone's taking a shower and it goes off, you have the photo type.
Which is good, right?
Which is good. The reason being
is...
So the photoelectric smoke detectors, they basically shoot a beam of light across. There's a mirror on the other side, and it measures the amount of particles in the air. So if you break that beam, or there's a certain number of breaks in that beam in a certain amount of time, it will set it off. So if your house is really, really dusty, or you're cleaning and things like that, you should set them off. The ionization smoke detector isn't going to get set off by that, typically. But they're meant for two different types of fires. So the ionization one actually has some radioactive material in it. Not enough to, you know, be a danger or anything like that, but unfortunately in the state of California and all that other stuff, it has those wonderful warnings. I wouldn't eat it or anything like that, obviously, but... what that does is it looks at the ions that are going through the air, and it creates an electrical impulse and all that wonderful stuff and sets off the thing. So most of the newer homes that are being built now, because building codes have changed, the newer houses, all the smoke detectors are all tied into one another. They're hardwired. So when one goes off, they all go off. So when all of your detectors go off because somebody's cooking down in the kitchen or wherever, that's why everything just goes crazy. The signal gets sent to all of them. The reason why they do that is we have really big houses now. Some people are up on the second floor, and there's a fire, say, in the garage on the first floor. When are you going to find out about it? You know, you want to find out about it as soon as possible. So the sooner you find out about it upstairs, the better off you're going to be. So that's why they're all connected. And they found that those types of systems work better. They alert people sooner. People know about it sooner. If you have to wait for the smoke to travel all the way across your house to get to the smoke detector that's in your bedroom, you could have a pretty significant fire by that time, depending on flow paths and things like that through your house. You may not know about it for a while. So, and that's all dependent on the wind outside. There's a number of factors that go into all that sort of stuff. So, I recommend if you have natural gas in your house, you need to have at least one smoke detector that's also a carbon monoxide detector, or have a carbon monoxide detector.
We test ours regularly.
It goes off a lot.
Carbon monoxide detector.
So, have you had your furnace checked recently?
We're
going to get a new one tomorrow.
Oh, well, it'll be interesting to see if your alarm continues to go off after you get your new furnace. So, one of the problems with natural gas is obviously the furnaces, they may not burn efficiently and they produce extra carbon monoxide gas, and it ends up all in your house. So, it is a concern. I've seen brand new houses that have had malfunctioning furnaces, like literally brand new houses, like the clients closed 30 days prior, and then, everybody in the house is sick with carbon monoxide poisoning. So, the mom ended up in the hospital, one of the children ended up in the hospital because of it. So it was a really big deal. So things do malfunction. I mean, just like anything else in our lives, things break, and we kind of take some of those things for granted. Oh, our furnace is always going to work, that sort of stuff. So, these are fire-related injuries from 2008 to 2017, and you can see the downward trend. So we're getting better at educating people. More people have smoke detectors, those sorts of things. So these numbers are good. I mean, we were at a high of 17,000, and now we're down to about 14,000. So that's pretty good improvement on things. Can you go to the next little trend, Steve, for me? Deaths. This one's good right here. So the number of fires last year, or 2 years ago now, 1.3 million, so down 6%. So we're getting better with the number of fires we have. But look at the increase in deaths. We're almost up 10%, so 3,400 last year, 2017. The injuries, this is pretty significant. It's down 15% from 2008, so that's good. The problem is more people are dying, which is bad. Our losses are a lot greater. So this affects everyone. $23 billion.
Are those the California fires?
Well, some of it is the wildfires have something to do with this, the losses, and some of the deaths as well. Obviously, if a wildfire sneaks up on you, you're not going to necessarily be able to outrun it. That's where looking at what you build your house out of and those sorts of things comes into play. So, do I have any more on there, Steve?
So that was fires. This is deaths. This is injuries. And this is loss.
So
that's the wildfire.
Yeah, so this is the wildfire spike here. But see where we're down? It's like 10.9 billion. So we're doing pretty good, and then we have a huge spike because of natural disaster or something like that. So this is the residential fires. 50.3% were made by cooking. Heating. So space heaters, furnaces malfunctioning, those sorts of things. Unintentional or careless. Those are kind of, smoking in bed or playing with a flamethrower. We all have those, Steve. And then electrical malfunction. So this is one that I don't know if we'll get these numbers down. They used to be a lot worse when we had knob and tube wiring, which was from basically the 1890s all the way up through the 1940s. We still have houses in Houston that have knob and tube wiring. I just had a fire at a house about 6 months ago in Galena Park, and it was knob and tube wiring. Somebody came in and bought it. And the thing with knob and tube wiring is it runs in your attic, and the wires are exposed. And you can't have anything touching or bridging between the two wires. So on one rafter is one wire, and on the other rafter is the other wire. And what happens when you run something between it? It makes a circuit, connects it, or it gets superheated because it can't be covered up. And unfortunately, CenterPoint Energy has updated their grid, and our electrical service is a lot better than it was in 1940 and 1950 and even the 60s. So their house, unfortunately, caught fire. they had a working smoke detector, and that's how they found out. So the fire was actually in the attic, and they were very lucky that they had a working detector, because the fire happened at 2:30 in the morning. And the gentleman who lived in the house told me, he said, I heard the alarm go off, I could see the smoke, and I knew something was burning because I could smell it. And his grandson was there at the house with them sleeping on the couch. And he said all he could think of was grabbing his wife and getting his son. And he came out of the house, and the fire was already through the roof. So it already burned a hole through the roof. So they were really lucky to be able to get out. It could have been pretty catastrophic. So I don't think I have any more YouTube videos, do I?
How many carbon monoxide detectors does one need in their home?
So typically what I recommend is at least one on every floor. You should have a minimum of one in your house. Preferably, you should also put one up in the attic where your furnace is as well. So two, I mean, more the better. The other thing about the smoke detectors now is you can get the combination detectors that are the ion detection, the photoelectric, and they have a built-in carbon monoxide detector. So then you have all three.
Does the monoxide go like low and the other one goes on the ceiling?
So that's one of the things about carbon monoxide. It disperses pretty evenly throughout the atmosphere. It's not one of these gases that just settles. The problem is when it's heated, you get all this convection and it just kind of moves around and it disperses.
Okay, throughout. So it's okay to have it on the ceiling.
Yes, on the ceiling is fine. They have ones, carbon monoxide detectors, that you can plug into an outlet, and it's fine. The way the carbon monoxide detectors work is the carbon monoxide has to get to a certain level before the alarm goes off. So if it's, one part per million, it's not going to go off. Two parts, it's not going to go off. Some of them will have, it'll be like 38.5 parts per million over a certain amount of time. Or if it's a sudden change, it's like 60 parts per million. Or if it's 180 parts per million, there's different programs in the detector. So in case there is a fire, that's the other advantage of having the carbon monoxide detector, is these fires put off a lot of carbon monoxide. So the carbon monoxide detector will go off as well. So what else?
So what should you teach your kids? Like drills or
so this is the other thing. So I live in a ranch house, so I've told the kids, this was a hard thing. So a couple months back, before I became the fire marshal, they had some firemen come to Naomi's school and they did the close the door campaign. And Naomi got very, very scared because she realized that, I'm the fireman that goes into these burning, like she realized that I'm the one that goes into these places and have to put fire out. But she asked me, and talk about like that moment where your kid just rips your heart out. She said, Daddy, I know when you're here, you'll get me out. But when you're at work, who's going to save me? And it's like, and I'm like, well, and luckily enough, I have friends at the fire station just down the street from the house. And I said, do you remember this guy? Do you remember that guy? Yeah, I remember them. And I said, well, they work down the street. They'll be the ones that will get you out. And she's like, well, what happens if I can't get out? And it's just, it's just one of those things. Like, you want to protect your kids. And, Robbie's not quite old enough to kind of understand some of that stuff. But Naomi's at a point where she does understand it. And I appreciate that. And we had the malfunctioning, smoke detector. It was an older one. Your smoke detector should get replaced again every 10 years. They're only good for 10 years. So if they're 10 years old, replace them. But we had one that was right about 10 years, and it was malfunctioning, and it went off one night after she had gone to sleep, and it scared her to death. Absolutely scared her to death. Because she knew what it is. I mean, our kids know. They do fire drills at school. They know what, an alarm sounds like. So, but I do. I try to teach them, look, if there's a fire, try to get out the front door, go across the street to Mr. Bill's house. So they know who Mr. Bill is. He's a neighbor across the street. And so the kids know this is where I need to go. And then I've taught them if they can't get out the front door or they can't get out of their bedroom door, close their door. And if they need to, break the window and go out the window. Because it's only, the window sits, 3 feet above the ground. So it's no big deal for them to get out. Naomi, I think, would be able to break the window. Robbie, I'm not quite sure what he would do. I think he would be scared and would want to break the window. And he'd be the kid to go hide under the bed and hide in the closet. So So, which is a problem. That's typically where we find younger kids. If we find them, they've decided to hide under the bed, or they go and try to hide in the closet. They try to get somewhere that they feel like they can be safe and get away from things. And unfortunately, that's where you find them. You'll find them buried underneath clothes in a closet, or you find them underneath the bed, you know, with their favorite stuffed animals and stuff. It's sad. Dogs will try to get out. Cats will go hide. Small children will go hide. I've had a few run-ins with cats hiding in closets, and it's not a fun experience, especially when they latch on and, you know, their claws go through your gear and you can't get them off. And, you know, so it makes for great joking at the firehouse. It's not fun. But, you know, when you're crawling through one of these houses and you find, you know, a 110-pound pit bull that's almost unconscious because of, you know, the carbon monoxide, that's scary too, because you're like, I found somebody, and then you realize, oh my gosh, this thing can eat me, but then it doesn't do anything, and you're like, okay, well, this is kind of sad. You still get them out of things, but, you know, a lot of times we can't see, so we don't know what we're, you know, we don't know what we're hitting, and a 110-pound dog feels just like a little kid or a person, and you can't see them, so, especially when you're wearing those big, heavy gloves and stuff, so do practice with your kids on where to go and how to get out of the house. Make sure they know, okay, I can go out my room through my door, but if I need to, I can go out my bedroom window, as long as you're on the first floor.
So what do you teach kids?
If they're on the second floor, you can. Your kids are almost old enough. Well, your oldest son is, and your oldest daughter. The two younger ones may have a little bit of problem with this, but they have the fire escape ladders that they can throw out the windows. That's the hard part with younger kids is they're not going to know what to do, and they're going to be looking to you. So that's the hard part. But just teaching your kids and practicing, the kids will learn, okay, if there's a fire, I know what to do. If my door is hot, I know not to go out, stay in my room, leave the door closed. I'm going to be safer in my room. Talk about those things with them. It's really important. And they'll listen. You may not think that they listen and they understand, but they do. They get it. They really, really do get it. So the other big thing is make sure you have a meeting point, because you all may not come out of the house together. But, you know, if you have that central meeting point, you'll be able to find your kids. I can't tell you how many fires I've made, and, you know, the kids are at the meeting point, and the parents are not at the meeting point. And the kids are like, I don't know where my mom and dad are. And dad's, like, trying to get back in the house to, like, save something that's not worth saving. And you know, mom's just, you know, lost it. And here are the kids, like, come on, mom and dad. This is, like, easy. Like, we practice this at school. And the kids do. They practice this stuff at school. They practice fire alarms at school.
Do you see ever where kids don't wake up even though the alarms are going off? Like, our kids slept through, all three of them slept through the fire alarms going off, and they have them in their bedrooms.
Yeah. So it's some people are sound sleepers, and it is a problem. I mean, one of the stats they talked about was the number of people that actually have working smoke detectors, and they still sleep through it. And so if you know that they're heavy sleepers, they have smoke detectors and warning devices for people that are deaf. They're basically like vibrating pads and things they can put under the pillow, and they vibrate if the smoke detector goes off. Because it's the only way they're going to know. They can't hear. So, and then there's visual strobes as well that you can get, which are really, really bright. And typically, like we all know, if somebody walks in your bedroom and flips on the light, you know, you're going to wake up. So the strobes also work. It's great that you have kids that can sing through.
I get the strobe lights, so they'd be like dancing.
Yeah. I was
like
scared.
A fire suppression system. Every false alarm.
So that's another thing that they're actually starting to install in houses. A lot of people don't realize this. If you're building a house, the cost of what it costs to put in your sprinkler system in your yard, you can get a sprinkler system installed in your house. And the break that you will get on your insurance will cover the cost. The savings will cover the cost for your sprinkler system in your yard.
Like they put it.
Like so in a commercial.
Show up like,
yeah, so when you're framing your house and they're putting in the pipes and everything, they can just run the pipes in there with everything else. they can come in and retrofit your house and install sprinklers into your house. So there are different rules for residential sprinklers. We all see the like cast iron pipes that we have in the commercial buildings. It's not what they install in residential. They install, they use PVC pipes. And there's different rules on those. And there's different systems and things. But you actually do get a rather huge insurance break. And it'll pay for the sprinkler system in the front yard.
What do they do for a false alarm on those things?
On what? On a
on like a fire suppression sprinkler system.
So typically, if it's a false alarm, your kids have probably, there's a little bulb in there, and the kids have broken the glass bulb that keeps the water back.
So we have false alarms typically at 3 in the morning in our house,
mm-hmm.
and like one of the, they're connected, so one of them is like, hey guys, I'm out of a battery, or what's
right.
You smell this, guys? And then everyone else is like, woo, crazy, crazy.
Right.
So if like the sprinkler system went off every time,
so the sprinkler system, that's not how sprinkler systems work. So inside the sprinkler head is a glass bowl that has a liquid in it, and each of these liquids has a certain temperature. And when it's heated, the liquid expands and it breaks the glass, and then the water comes out.
I see.
So that's the kind that you would have in your house. Yeah. Typically, those would be set to go off at, you know, 155 degrees Fahrenheit. So you're not gonna set it off by your furnace. You know, you're not gonna be able to heat your house up to 155 degrees Fahrenheit unless you light it on fire.
Yeah.
Where there's a fire.
Hold the zipper right there.
And you can get them to go off. And that's a misconception about sprinklers. People think that, well, if one goes off, they all go off. They don't. Just the one that's open goes off. In industrial settings, they have what are called deluge systems, and they actually use a heat detector, and then they have a smoke detector. And if both of those go off, it will literally flood the system with water, and then all of them will open up. But there's different rules for all those sorts of things, and it depends on what's in the building. And I mean, they have foam suppression systems for aircraft hangars, you know, and there's a heat detector and a smoke detector, and there's emergency buttons.
Can you get
and
foam for your house?
You could get foam for your house. Your insurance company would like that too, because foam is much more efficient at putting out fires, and you don't have all the water damage. So, you know, foam party. With your strobe light. So,
the one thing on interest, like I had a friend who had a fire in their garage, and it took their whole house out. And their big thing was smoke damage to their house, and some stuff got destroyed. But like, now that you have a cell phone with a camera, like just take
pictures
of everything. Take, you know, 15 pictures of room, and just take pictures of everything. Put it on Google, and forget about it, because.
If you don't have an inventory, it's a problem with the insurance companies. Because unfortunately, there have been plenty of people who said, "Yeah, I had 10 Rolex watches in this dresser, and you know,
they melted,
and the fireman must have taken them." And you know, we have people that do that. I mean, you'll come and you know, they'll say, "Oh, you guys stole my Rolex," and all kinds of stuff. And it's like, why would we steal your Rolex? And you know, we don't do that, you know. So people even get upset, like we go to fires and people have lots and lots of guns, and that's a huge problem for us as well. Ammunition is not fun in fires, because it still goes off whether it's in the barrel or not, and you don't know when it initially goes pop whether or not it's in the barrel or not. But anyway, hopefully you guys got something out of this. Smoke detectors, close your door at night, tell your kids, you know, be honest with them, have a plan, tell them where you want them to meet. You know, my kids know if there's ever a problem at our house, they can go to Mr. Bill's house across the street. And just tell your neighbor, hey, you know, you're my meeting point. And luckily enough, you know, Mr. Bill across the street, he knows that if my kids come knocking on his door and we're not with them, there's a problem. So, you know, whether it's a medical emergency or whatever, teach your kids, you know, hey, go over to the neighbor's house. Because it could, you know, could ultimately save your life. Thank you for letting me talk.
Thank you.